having people see you and hear you. If even they don't agree with you, just hear you and see you, that spirit can carry into your writing and what you feel like you can and cannot write and the boundaries that you push within yourself.
Yeli Sawita Kamara is a poet. Her first full-length collection just came out. But teaching, in the community as well as the classroom, that's also central to her work. This week, Yeli and I talk about the importance of community for being a writer, how her life changed when she moved to the Midwest, and more. That's coming up after this. To be a poet, Raina Maria Rilke said, what you need is solitude. Great inner solitude. That is what one must learn to attain. To be able to go within and meet no one else for hours. But it ain't easy. In certain periods of our lives, just the logistics are almost impossible. We have roommates or families, colleagues at work. In some ways, remote work has probably helped some people have more alone time, for better or worse. But that brings us to the other dilemma. Even if we're not around other people, we still have our devices. We can check our email every couple of minutes or... wait, I got a text. Hang on. Okay. Oh, and there's so much content out there. Audiobooks, YouTube videos, social media, and radio and podcasts. They all keep us company in a way. And they also distract us from that great inner solitude Rilke was talking about. I don't blame us. It can be lonely. It can be scary, almost. Tasting that inner freedom, which is also our aloneness, can leave us unmoored. Which is why we like to distract ourselves. I've always thought that to be a writer, you had to be able to go inwards, cultivate that solitude. I don't think the poet Yeli Sawita Kamara would disagree. But as a working poet, which is to say as someone who writes both her own work and leads workshops and teaches at a university, Yeli also cultivates community and collaboration. For example, in 2022, she became the Cincinnati and Mercantile Library Poet Laureate. As part of that, she invited people from across the city and northern Kentucky to write about what they've discovered in Cincinnati. Then she assembled their words into a poem, and it was displayed at Blink, which is the city's biennial festival of light and art. She's working on another series of polyvocal poems for the next festival this spring. That's just one example of Yeli's work in the community. She came up as a poet through 826 Valencia and Youth Speaks, two writing programs in San Francisco for young folks. And her first full-length collection has just come out. It's called Bisedu. Bisedu won the 2023 Jake Adam York Prize, and it's been featured on a lot of most anticipated book lists in the past few months, including Lit Hub and a mention in the New York Times Book Review. If you're curious about the title, don't worry, we talked about it. But I started by asking her about the solitary work of writing poetry and how that interfaces with the very public work of teaching.
So in terms of thinking about the balance between like a sort of poetry and writing being a sort of isolated and solitary endeavor, which it is, versus teaching, I think for me, I really benefit from that interplay. I'm someone who does like to write on their own and actually not just write on my own. I know that my practice has kind of shifted by virtue of the laureateship and where a lot of my writing does happen kind of in community now too, insofar as wanting to participate or taking time to participate in sort of the writing prompts and the activities that are being facilitated to work and write alongside folks that I'm blessed to be working with. I also think that teaching keeps me from being super weird. You know, you're around other people, you know, like... You have to like kind of like remember social mores and like how to interact and how to be helpful and useful. And so there's something about that sort of the freshness of ideas from students, the buoyancy, the questions, the vulnerability, the spaces that we can create. I think it keeps me from becoming hardened by my own thoughts or like deepening into my own sort of queries, and allows me to have a sort of maybe suppleness of mind and spirit and kind of access to compassion and humanity through interfacing with students that are coming from all these different walks of life that are contributing these really interesting thoughts. They're really beautiful and they don't preclude a type of honesty. And so to have that sort of thing around me, I think also keeps my will to be curious alive.
Do you think you could potentially lose a kind of honesty yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. If I was not talking to people around me, I could lose that honesty. If I was not engaging with the writing of others or art of others, I could lose that honesty. Like if I was to myself, I could lose an honesty because maybe I become so introspective that I gain a type of honesty on the inside that I'm afraid of sharing, or I lose a type of access to myself. And I'm just kind of thinking about like who I was during the pandemic that we're still in. So, I mean, the beginning of the pandemic and thinking about that sort of honesty that was so feral and bewildering and something that I had not experienced before in that type of isolation, but also how I feel grounded and was availed to, I don't know, maintaining a type of vulnerability by speaking with those around me.
That you've been able to maintain through teaching and being in community.
Well, and during the pandemic, yes, I was thinking about that time. I think also now, like to parallel that, yes, I think that there's a type of, I guess, plenty put the students keep me honest. They keep me honest. They ask good questions. And I think their models of honesty are inspiring to me.
And is that, well, I'm curious, is that honesty like a kind of vulnerability, or is that a quality of it, or is it a kind of desire to or willingness to communicate in a way that, say, a poem could sort of turn in on itself and our writing could just become kind of writing solely for ourselves?
I think it is a type of vulnerability, and I think students can weigh this out really quickly. The vulnerability versus like what do I have to lose, or what will I lose if I keep this to myself? And I think that they're very quick at doing that in ways that I marvel at. And I think what often wins out is the vulnerability.
And is that a good thing?
Absolutely.
Okay. I mean, absolutely. Because I think there's a tension there too, just to keep going with like various tensions of, especially when we're thinking about trying to create something that's going to be meaningful for other people, the tension between wanting to, you know, communicate something in a way that's meaningful versus just kind of like throwing everything out there and saying everything in a way, I think, you know, that maybe social media sometimes encourages also. Does that make sense?
I guess
a formlessness?
I mean, does it have to make sense to other people? Is that like the imperative of writing? I don't know if that is.
Yeah,
I don't
know if that.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what I'm seeking out in a creative writing class. I would hope that my students feel like they're better readers, that they can trust their aesthetic sensibilities and their impulses. And I think like vulnerability does have a value in workshop settings that I like to be a part of. There is a type of respect and caring for each other and hearing each other and holding each other. And so I do think that on the one level, like being able to speak and feel vulnerable and comfortable is one thing. And I think that sort of spirit, having people see you and hear you, if even they don't agree with you, just hear you and see you, that spirit can carry into your writing and what you feel like you can and cannot write, and sort of the boundaries that you push within yourself. And I think if that happens at any point in a creative writing space, whether over a semester, over an hour, over a week, that's a feat.
I feel like there's also a lot of really beautiful vulnerability in the book. And it really comes across.
I forgot that's what we're here for.
We're supposed to be talking about the book, Yaeli. We're launching the book. No, this is all really great. But I would love to also talk about the book because there's so much there as well. And I want you to read like every poem. Okay, maybe we can choose between two poems. Maybe you can help me choose. where to go. Biseidu, I was interested in hearing because I think it opens up, you know, thinking about the title, thinking about your relationship with your mother and also the questions about language and Americanness. But then also Elegy for My Two-Step feels like it gets at something we were just talking about. I'm guessing it feels like it was written in a time of solitude. I'm really curious to hear about both of them. We could eventually do both of them, but are you leaning one way or the other?
Yeah, I think because I'm already on Biseidu, maybe that's where it's at. Biseidu. While sipping coffee in my mother's Toyota, we hear the bird call of two teenage boys in the parking lot. One says, Biseidu, the other returns as they reach for each other. Their cupped handshake pops like the first fat firecrackers of summer. Their fingers shimmy as if they're solving a Rubik's Cube just beyond our sight. Moments later, their Schwinn's head in opposite directions. My mother turns to me, revealing the milky John Waters mustache thin foam on her upper lip. Waiting den Biseidu, na English, she asks, tickled by this tangle of new language. All right, be safe, dude. I pull apart each syllable like string cheese for her. Oh yeah, dem na le padi, she smiles, surprisingly broken by the tenderness expressed by what half my family might call thugs. Biseidu, 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 we chirp in the car, then nightly into our phones after I leave California. Biseidu, she says, as she softly muffles the rattling of my bones in newfound sobriety. Biseidu, I say years later, her response made raspy by an oxygen treatment at the ER. Biseidu, we whisper to each other across the country, like some word from deep in a somewhere too newborn pure for the outdoors, but we saw those two boys do it in broad daylight under a decadent, ruinous sun. Biseidu, Biseidu, we say, Biseidu, and split one more for the road. For all the struggle, tumble, drown, Biseidu, we say, to get on the good foot. We get off of the phone, tight like the bulbous air of two palms that have just kissed.
Thank you. It's so great. You know, there's so much in the book that's about things that are really hard. And there's a lot of really, you know, strong feeling and sincerity. And this poem, you know, acknowledges some hardness. But there's also like this playfulness to it, this kind of like cheekiness in, you know, in the phrase Biseidu and, you know, be safe, dude. And that's what sort of like bubbles out of that. What made it feel like the right thing to be the title poem of the book?
I don't get asked this question enough. I love this. So the title of the book, which was my thesis title originally, was Loud Organs and Extraordinary Horns. And that felt like the spirit of the book. And I'd just written this poem in, I want to say, July of 2019. And Ross did a reading, Ross Gay did a reading in Cincinnati in, I want to say, October of 2019. And he and our friend Kate and Stephanie were all with me. I was doing writing workshops at Wordplay. And I read the poem to them before I entered the space. And we just to share some new work with them. And a few days later, or maybe it was that same day, actually, Ross was like, it was a few days later. I sent him the poem and he said, that would make an excellent book title. And I backspaced Loud Horns and Extraordinary Organs, and I typed in Biseidu, and I was like, whoa, everything kind of locked in place for me. And I realized that the poem, the title before, was a placeholder for the spirit of the poem, of the collection. And Biseidu was the actual name of it. And I think that like the spirit of the original title was actually completely embodied in the phrase Biseidu. And so that's how the title came about.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I don't even know if Ross remembers that he did that, but it changed everything for the book.
Did it feel like it changed the book overall too?
It didn't feel like it changed the book overall, but I will say it gave me that last little push to finish the book. It got me really excited about finishing the book.
Yeah. And it's so interesting just as a phrase because it's, you know, it's not clear what it means until you read the poem, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've heard people, I've overheard people. I was on a Zoom call and I stepped away and it was a group of older women I was speaking with. And I left the volume up and they're like, Bisedu, is that something from Sierra Leone? Is that something from like a dialect? And another older lady was like, no, read the poem, you know? And so I really appreciate how things carry sort of sonically. And it's kind of, there's a defamiliarization of the words on the word on the page and just how people find their way to it. And what's been awesome about that is it's been cool to hear people say Bisedu or tell me that they share it with their loved ones or they've say it to each other, and a friend shared that he overheard at his party. And also it also creates this forum where other people share their family words. And so it's been really cool to kind of just hear about this kind of, or just to be in the center of this sort of constellation of shared and created language that pulls us closer.
It's time for a break. I'm talking with the poet Yaeli Sawita Kamara. Her first full-length collection, Bisedu, came out in January. When we come back, we'll hear another poem and talk about how Yaeli's life has changed in and because of the Midwest. Stick around. It's Interstates. I'm Alex Chambers. I'm talking with poet Yaeli Sawita Kamara. Let's get right back to it. I do want to talk about place a bit. This show, my show, Interstates, is partly thinking about place in the Midwest and what it means to be here. You are from Oakland. Did you move to the Midwest originally to Bloomington for your MFA?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And you have a few poems about Bloomington and some wonderful poems about Oakland. I was sort of thinking about Elegy for My Two-Step potentially as one to think about place as well. The other one I was kind of thinking about was the more prosy one where you're describing meeting a pastor, I think, and the pastor commenting on where that person is from as like a dangerous place.
That poem. That is Eulocticus, I think?
Yes, yes.
Yes, I will try. I will try hard to read it. I'll be careful. It's just, you know, with the spacing like this, it takes some time to, you know, that's part of the poem.
Oh, I didn't think about that. I was sort of saw this short piece as it's three pages. Right. That totally makes sense. And I read it along and it felt like a continuation, but I didn't think about it as like actually being.
I'll give it a go. I'll give it a go.
I think it'll be fun to see how it unfolds.
Fun for you. Okay. Eulocticus. After the service in the auditorium, the congregation lines up to greet the pastor, as if he himself were a second coming. Every man is joined to his wife, who is joined to a bonnet, who is joined to a bun and a bundle of babies. When it's the guest's turn, he cannot control himself. Your hair is like Angela Davis's or Colin Kaepernick's. Well, which is it? He asks, as if to quiz her. She smiles instead, taking neither option. Eulocticus, that's what they call your hair. It means woolly, big. She thanks him for the word, for what she knows will be the only gift she will receive. Where are you from? She responds, wow, that's tough, he says, not realizing that she grew up seeing more than and never witnessed a. It reminds me of growing up in Chicago. My family used to take a couple of kids out of the Robert Taylor homes every summer to go swimming. It used to be scary walking through those project courtyards, real scary. Scary, she thinks, as she imagines the boys running back to their hell after an afternoon in his. Bloomington must be hard. Not a good place for people like you, she retorts, countering his assumption. But Providence, she thinks. She thinks, she says. But God, she says. But God, she says. It's well. I am well. It is good. I am. I am. I am the one who has gone. Fine. I'm going. Going to go. I am gone. Going to leave now. You. I am going to leave. You cannot really hear me screaming now. Leave my hair. Me. Gone. Gone. Disappear. Goodbye. It's fine. I am screaming. Disappear. Well, I'm going now. I am going, going to leave. Well, I am the one going to leave my hair. It is I who has to go. Leave now. You, me, good. You cannot. I am gone. I am gone. Really hear me. Gone, gone. Goodbye.
Yeah. Formally, I should say, that last section that kind of feels repeated is quite spread out on the page, and you read it across and then down in columns?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which I didn't think to read it that way when I was reading the book to myself. So it's nice.
Well, this is the power of community that we've been talking about.
Exactly. Yes. The different ways, and not just the hearing this like through conversation, but just opening up the different ways you can encounter a poem and think about how it works. So what I was curious to ask was, how did moving to the Midwest change how you thought about either the country or yourself?
So I think living in the Midwest, a couple of things, well, actually a lot of things have happened. I think moving to the Midwest changed my life and in the sense that it saved my life in a lot of ways. It's a lot about the Midwest. I think one thing is thinking about encountering community in a really beautiful way in the Bay Area, and then seeing a whole nother way of thinking about community in the Midwest. And I think the Midwest is kind of, I've never been to Community Orchard before. You know, I never have participated in writing workshops that took place both on campus and a writing workshop that had nothing to do with campus, and the possibility of those things existing, or going to another place where you can do a little bit of farm labor and have food to last you for a very long time. When you think about it, the point really isn't the labor, it's to give you food. And thinking about, you know, I got baptized actually in Bloomington. Not actually, of course it happened in the Midwest, but it happened in Bloomington, and being able to walk to a place of worship and to be able to know that that's just not too far outside of my door was something that was really important to me. All these different ways of people filling you up with a type of love and care, artistically, spiritually, something that was different. And maybe it's also part of the community, or the feeling is being able to walk to things in a way that spatially it's a different place, you know, to be able to look and see, to see like sample gates from a particular part of town and be like, I can walk to work and see work. Whereas, you know, living in California, I was like in commute about 25 hours a week. And so being able to walk 15 minutes, all these things sort of change like how you see the possibility of your own time. And I did find ways of using my time, like, you know, like that commute time was spent writing applications, right? And completing applications and personal statements and getting writing samples together. I like made time, use of that time. But it's different when you can use your time in a way that is maybe more yours, you know? And what else about the Midwest? There's a type of, I'm meaning to say, a type of quality of life that I think I've encountered here that as a grad student, in maybe other regions of America, I would not be able to have, right? And so there's something very special about that. And Even now, I feel like the place where I live, I would have to have like 86 roommates in the Bay Area. You know what I mean? And so, like, there's something really cool about space to be by oneself in a way. I will say that the speed of the Midwest has been something that has allowed me to have greater access to my thoughts. And I would say, tied to that, is maybe hearing in a different way. And part of that, I think, is tied to thinking about particular choices in my life that show up in the collection and thinking about sobriety. Maybe that slowness of life allowed me to think about how my life could be better without certain influences and certain people. And I think those sorts of things happen, I think, with pace and with a type of isolation that I encountered in the Midwest, and not this sort of like, I don't mean it in this sort of like exiled way, but in a way that I just was able to turn in a little bit more to myself. I think those are some of the changes that I encountered. I feel like I've talked so much. How has it changed me? I feel a deeper sense of spirituality and gratitude, I think, living here. And it'd be interesting to see what would happen if it, you know, like how what has the Midwest activated in me that it can take to other places. But I think I'm more loving. I think that's what happened living in the Midwest. I think I've gotten more loving. I'm still snobby in some ways, but I
Good for
think I have
you.
a great,
Hold on to that too.
I'm gonna hold on to that. It's righteous snobbiness. But I think I've encountered these incredibly creative acts of love that have taught me how to be a fuller human. And I think part of that is maybe age too, but I definitely believe that that has to do with a lot of it has to do with living in the Midwest.
And that's been the case also in Cincinnati, which is, of course, a bigger city than Bloomington. Is that the case?
It is. It's a friend. I walk quicker, you know, when I moved from Bloomington, which kind of felt like Polly Pocket, you know, just kind of booping and bopping all over town. I realized I was walking quite slow and I was sauntering, I was moseying. So I had to pick up pace a little bit in Cincinnati. But it has been an incredibly kind city to me, and it's a city where there is a welcoming of artistic innovation and collaboration. And that even was kind of how this Blink project came to be, was someone believed in an idea that I had, and I was able to take off with it. And so I've been really grateful to be in a city too that is excited about the arts as well. And I think a lot of that training and that thinking about art in this sort of human and collaborative way too, I will absolutely credit Bloomington for having a part of that too. And so I think like that is like a really blessed order of things to have moved from Bloomington to Cincinnati. And I feel grateful to not be so far from Bloomington ever. And that feels really, really cool. I don't think that's something that I necessarily understood when I didn't understand that when I first moved from California, what Bloomington would eventually mean to me. So, yeah.
That's really cool and interesting to hear about the kind of healing that being in a place like this allowed, that then maybe came through and helped you develop further in your writing as well.
Oh, absolutely. I found my writing voice in Bloomington. Like I found God in my writing voice in Bloomington. And I had some ideas and a lot more questions before I moved to the Midwest. And so, yeah, it's such an unexpected thing to like get off of a plane like with my mom and be like, Mom, did you think that when you moved to America that you'd ever end up walking through Bloomington, Indiana with your daughter? You know, just kind of having these like moments where like, what is going on? And that's the surprise and just kind of the gift of life, just things you don't expect to happen. I did not expect any of these things to happen to me when I moved to Bloomington or to the Midwest in general.
You said you found God and your writing voice in Bloomington. Can you say more about that?
I can read you a poem about it.
Please, even better.
Yeah, I'll read you Bloomington, Indiana, part one. I think that encapsulates that whole thing.
Right, page 40.
Page 40 is okay. There we go. Excellent. Thank you. I can't wait until I start to memorize these page numbers so I can just. Bloomington, Indiana, part one. Before I learn to die unto myself, I am told by a pastor who I had just met when visiting an aunt who I had only previously spoken to on the phone, that my life could kill me. The way I hold myself, he says, between the pinch of the index finger and thumb is simply not enough. I tussle with the warning, then let it ring in the middle of my ear for a week before I begin to empty myself of myself. I'd never been told this by a stranger, but think I agree. I believe I could be slowly dying, particularly when thinking of every morning after every evening that started out as an escape. I say farewell to the comforts of Indiana that make the move from the Bay Area feel easy. These comforts are so cheap that they appear exotic. Goodbye, $3 shots and $2 pints. I exhale the last American spirit and clean the final bullet wound. I let go of my acquaintance with bile. I upchuck the garnet and bubble gut the amber of Midwestern excess. I think being around friends who still partake in a life that is not good for me will have no effect, but in their presence, I feel the urge to backstep. A strange, loud booming, heart-racing anxiety gnaws at me from the inside. This ugly sensation is the beginning of a lifestyle change. I erase Tinder, but before I do, I stare long at the handsome man who pins down an antlered creature in his profile pic. In real life, I scrub all the John Deere from the pore and the membrane and the bedsheet. There is so much on which to swipe left in my own life. This business of being careful is heavy. I commit tentatively. I stay away from bars as often as I can, which means missing out on some MFA events. I skip parties too. Though I stop drinking, I leave a bottle of Cardinal vodka in my fridge for a month before throwing it out. Though I become celibate, I don't erase the numbers of my favorites. Nothing is completely immediate. There is an ever so slight feeling of safety in the thought of returning to the ritual of toxic behavior. I don't quite know what is possible in my own life, though I want to be a writer and wish to be more centered. The difficulty here is I don't understand the extent of wishing and hoping or the far reaches of dreaming. I keep being told that permanent change cannot be made in private. I don't understand that fully either, but want to hear from others. For the first time in my life, I begin to go to church. Not before saying no to many. The church where the music sounds distorted. The one where the pastor in training lays hands on my head to perform a holiness I cannot feel. The one with the delicious communion bread and banjos, but is far too quiet for my West African sensibilities. I join a Baptist church where they shout and cry, where everyone is broken but trying. The one in which honest sinners are happy to hold my hand and double squeeze my knuckle at the end of prayer, mercy. I like that the church is walking distance from my home, but feel worried about attacks on Black congregations. One of the parishioners is a sheriff. He makes sure to always park his squad car in front of the church. He prays and sings mellifluously throughout every service. My stomach knots after the first time I see it. When he turns to put tithes in the collection plate, the motion reveals his holstered gun. This is an open carry state, even in the sanctuary. Community helps. Time helps too, but really solitude deserves more credit in the conversation on healing. I become more able to steer clear of my ennui and my ratchet. I go to the library to study line breaks by myself. I tell my friends it's about to get weird, then lose most of them. Glory! I find my favorite places to hide. One of them is in my kitchen. Something about the space gets me. It is small and tucked away, like my life here. While it is a place to cook, it is also a place to cry, to arc, to bend, to break, to come back together with no human watching. I soothe with a book of John, Psalms, pamplemousse, la croix, vegan apple cider donuts, new wigs, podcasts, my mouth ever agape, agape, embouchure. After a season, I aqueous unravel in the waters of baptism. After I dry, wet stained glass is still trickling from my ear. I find a metaphor in this, something about praise being messy. Most things are bright and the sound is loud. This is a type of rising from sleep. All of this in Bloomington, Indiana. What I knew but did not want to know was that a friend was called a monkey and spat on around the corner from my apartment. What I remembered but did not want to remember was the car with the tinted windows that once followed me for blocks. What I recall but want to forget is why we never stopped for gas in Martinsville. What doesn't surprise me is that neo-Nazis sell fresh produce at the farmer's market. I am certain the blood never dries in Indiana. I am also certain that the blood never loses its power. This is where I found my God nodding me awake. Talitha Kum, Talitha Kum.
One of the things I appreciate about the poem is that there are so many kind of moments of finding presence in this place. But it's funny because, you know, I had read it a couple times, but still, as we got to the end, I was like, oh, this place is sounding so wonderful and beautiful and, you know, just kind of perfect. And then we are reminded that it's also got its own messes as well.
Yeah.
And just that third to last line, I am certain the blood never dries in Indiana. I am also certain that the blood never loses its power. It feels like it's a line that feels resonant in some ways for the book as a whole, too, in the sense that there's an awareness certainly of violence throughout some of the poems. And as I've mentioned a couple times, also a fair amount of loss. And that sadness and that hurt is something that we all kind of have to be with, but that it also, it gives us something, I think, too.
Mm-hmm. It's, thank you for that. And it's from, you know, trying to go to church and going to a Baptist church. And this is one of the songs that is one of the gospel songs, some lines from that, and thinking about just like the majesty of the Almighty and how it flows to all these different places and how there's kind of an everlasting presence like in faith. And so thinking about that as this sort of divine imagery, but also the very real brutality of blood never drying in America and perhaps the most American part of America, in the top three most American parts of America.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. And that is this sort of twinned legacy, both on earth as it is in heaven, which is really interesting to walk through, thinking along the lines of like race and faith in this century.
All right, let's take another break. I'm talking with poet Yeli Sawita Kamara. She's the Cincinnati and Mercantile Library Poet Laureate, and her poetry collection Bisedu came out in January. When we come back, we'll talk about Auntie X, a family member who makes multiple appearances in the book, at one point hiding from immigration agents in a hospital morgue. Stay with us. Welcome back to Interstates. I'm Alex Chambers. I'm talking with Yeli Sawita Kamara about her debut poetry collection, Bisedu. Among other things, the book is about what we can learn from the people who came before us, especially our own ancestors, and how we can take care of each other. I think the cover kind of gets at that. It's a rich golden yellow, and there are two hands reaching up into the air, maybe giving each other a high five, maybe about to clasp each other in love or support. I would love to hear about Auntie X. She's such an interesting, fascinating character in the book. You know, she comes in with that wonderful poem, which is kind of a story, too, about her being in the hospital and having something in the 1980s. So I don't know if it was Immigration and Customs Enforcement called on her, mm-hmm. if that was the mm-hmm. organization then, but I guess it was. And she's like kind of saucy, I feel like. And she's just, you know. But then also at the end of the book, of course, there's this really heartbreaking poem thinking about the loss of a son of hers, too. I don't know that I have a good question. I would just love to hear about kind of what she means for the book. And I guess something I'm thinking about is what it means to be keeping stories alive for family members who are still here as well as those who are gone.
Yeah. Yeah. So I Auntie X is Auntie X by virtue of the enormity of her life. And I don't know who else would see Auntie X in this way, or who would think about, and it's possible, I just don't know anybody around me that would think of Auntie X as a human and also almost a myth, you know, and thinking about the sort of grandeur and the sort of expansiveness in, of her life. And she's someone who I do not believe, I know actually has not been told how huge her life is, or has not been dignified in a way that her stories are kept. And I, just being in her presence and growing up with her, I've just become increasingly fascinated by her as kind of one of the first like women in my life that I thought was so cool. And she had like a faded, or has a faded tattoo, you know, like from like, I don't know, life like in Sierra Leone, like in a, I don't even know what it says, but just kind of like the first time maybe I saw a tattoo up close, I was like, wow, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't, Sierra Leone women could have tattoos, you know? And kind of thinking about the ways that she tells stories in this kind of nonchalant way, and the ways that she talks about life, and her voice never, ever changes. It's always this sort of like same sort of kind of sweet and placid sort of tone. And she's telling you these things where you have to kind of lean in to listen to the rise and the fall of the story. And there's a casual like laugh here and there, but I'm like, wow, like this is a story that is about people becoming invisible. You know, like in the poem where, you know, my mother says, don't repeat this, so I must tell you, I think is the title of the poem or something along those lines. I should actually, that's not responsible. Let me tell you what the actual title of the poem is. because my mother says, don't repeat this, you must know. And just thinking about that line, or that poem and that story, and how she's essentially disappears or becomes invisible in some ways. And then by the end of the book.
And that's because just for listeners, that's because she's been working in this hospital and she's an immigrant.
Right, and there's questions around her status, her immigration status. And so kind of what happens when a group of people collaborates to disappear someone in the interests of their survival. Right. And then the reappearance of Auntie X near the end of the book, in which she's kind of in grief, or is in grief and dealing with the loss of her son by suicide, and thinking about disappearances in that way and reappearances through love, and what can reconciliation or a sort of healing do to kind of resurface someone who has been lost. And so thinking about that and thinking about cultural practices that help bring that to the fore is something that I was interested in too. And just kind of actually that poem started off as a creative nonfiction piece. And that didn't feel.
The last poem, or the poem at the hospital, because my mother says to repeat this.
I'm continuing talking about Auntie X moving from.
Yes.
Yes. To the last few poems Auntie X's Dream Door has, and then Auntie X becomes a unit of light. That the final poem.
Right, the one that's considering, about the grief about her son, who then comes back as a spirit around the table.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. And so thinking about that, and it was important for me to think about the poem ending in light and the book ending in light. And the first poem, is this the first poem? Give me a second. Just kind of like figuring out the anatomy of my own book. Yes, the first poem, Oakland is Home, Home is Myth. The final line in that poem is, the object that casts the biggest shadow is the one closest to the light. And the final line of the final poem is also considering light. And it's Auntie X thanks God for not leaving her in the dark. And so it was important for me to envelop the book in a type of light. I'm just, you know, I think in sort of thinking about Auntie X, or other people that show up in this collection. Some have stories and they've been profiled in other ways that bring kind of like a particular attention to who they are. There are other people who are sort of unsung heroes, and I'm invested in bringing that story to a greater audience. And there are all sorts of things we can learn from people that we don't necessarily position as our teachers. And I think that sort of spirit of like not giving a voice to the voiceless, that's like yucky, but I'm talking about like amplifying voices, right? My grandmother and my mother all are incredible storytellers, and I'm not smarter than they are. I just had particular opportunities that they didn't have. So thinking about the sort of like richness of the people in the worlds that I come from and just wanting to celebrate that, I think is what I'm trying to do with these poems. And yes, this is it's a hard thing to celebrate or a hard thing to talk about loss of life, but it's important to celebrate who people are and who people become and who people were before they were struck by a type of tragedy. And so this book is also thinking about overall, like, what do we overcome and what do we share in our overcoming with others as a way of sort of engaging that spirit and them or igniting that sort of will to continue and will to thrive within them.
And so much of that has to do, I think, with community and being with others.
Yes. Yeah. And the hands, absolutely in the hands, which is kind
just
of like
that. Fingers together.
Yeah. You know, with the thinking about the Sierra Leonean proverb at the beginning, ango ankam, is thinking about, you know, and I'll actually read that. So starting at the very beginning of the book and thinking about the hands, and I want to give a shout out to the graphic designer at Milkweed, Mary Austin Speaker, who is a graduate of the IU's MFA creative writing program.
She's okay, very cool.
And a brilliant graphic designer. I'm just grateful to Milkweed in general for all of this amazing work. But the Sierra Leonean Creole proverb is ango ankam. And it's like if you were to translate it literally, a hand goes, hand comes, which means the helping hand that leaves and love returns in loyalty. So there's always a return, and there's always this sort of in order to move forward, we have to always be looking behind us and to the sides of us also. And there's a responsibility and honor in doing that.
Ah, beautiful. Thank you, Yaeli. This has been really wonderful.
Thank you. This has been great.
That's it for the show. You've been listening to Interstates from WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. If you have a story for us or you've got some sound we should hear, let us know at wfiu.org/interstates. And hey, if you like the show, review and rate us on Apple or Spotify. And tell a friend. Okay, we've got your quick moment of slow radio coming up. But first, the credits. Interstates is produced and edited by me, Alex Chambers, with Avi Forrest. Our social media master is Jillian Blackburn. We get support from Ea Bonbinder, Mark Chilla, Louian Johnson, Sam Schemenauer, Peyton Whaley, and Kate Young. Our executive producer is Eric Bolstridge. Our theme song is by Amy Olsner and Justin Vollmer. We have additional music from the artists at Universal Production Music. All right, time for some found sound. That was Walking on the Boardwalk at McCormick's Creek State Park. Until next week, I'm Alex Chambers. Thanks, as always, for listening.
Riding back at the top of the Hunter's Moon.